Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our regular discussion group, hosted by the Consistent Democrats. Today we are studying Chapter 6 of State and Revolution by Lenin, and it's titled The Vulgarization of Marxism by the Opportunists. Ian's going to talk for about half an hour, and then I will open it up for discussion, questions, and general discussion. I remind comrades that we are being recorded, so if you do speak, please try to keep it to one at a time. And okay, and the floor is yours. Take it away.
Okay, thank you, comrades. Right, now this chapter is called, as we'll say, it's the chapter six, the final chapter of State and Revolution. It's called The Vulgarization of Marxism by the Opportunists. And this chapter just rounds off the book, really, by illustrating how various supposedly illustrious leaders of the Second International tried desperately to evade the question of the state, and in particular, the need to smash the existing capitalist state machine that was the core of Marx and Engels' developed understanding. And as Lenin said, he was addressing these questions briefly. We'll obviously address them still more briefly because the discussion doesn't have time to go into too much detail, and nor do we need to. The words of Kautsky and Plekhanov in World War I speak for themselves, I think. Plekhanov, Georgi Plekhanov, was earlier known as the father of Russian Marxism, and Lenin and the Bolsheviks, in a sense, stood on his shoulders for his pioneering work in the what's called the Emancipation of Labour Group, which began in 1883 in Russia, which coincidentally was also the year that Marx died. But Plekhanov certainly was a pioneer, but his politics over time revealed his limitations. And even though he founded Iskra, the famous newspaper, along with Lenin in 1900, and he initially sided with Lenin in the dispute over the definition of party membership that was the basis for the Menshevik and Bolshevik split in 1903, ultimately he still gravitated towards the Mensheviks. Although he was in favour of a strong party with an effective paper, which is a positive, obviously, he increasingly embraced reformism and social chauvinism, and he supported Russia in the First World War in 1914. And Lenin's brief account of his controversy with the anarchists notes that Plekhanov made no mention of the need to smash the existing capitalist state and replace it with a state consisting of the armed working class, in his controversy with the anarchists. I mean, there's not much more you can say about this, really. It's a fairly short section anyway. Going on to Kautsky, that's probably better known, is that Karl Kautsky, who was one of the leading figures of German social democracy, engaged in a conflict with Edward Bernstein, who was the revisionist, the arch revisionist of what was the SPD, the Socialist Party of Germany, and the Second International. And that is better known. It was paralleled by Rosa Luxemburg's famous polemic against Bernstein, which was called Reform or Revolution, where she concluded that reform and revolution were not different ways of travelling on the same road to socialism, but entirely different roads. Now, Kautsky's own controversy with Bernstein was in an 1899 work called Bernstein and the Social Democratic Programme, and it involves some kind of defence of Marx and Engels against what amounted to a false polemic in which Bernstein attempted to associate the Marxists with blankism, which was a particular view that sort of projected that a revolutionary minority could seize power without the masses being active participants. And Bernstein also tried to tried repeatedly to identify Marx's views on the Paris Commune with those of the French anarchist Pierre Proudhon. And Bernstein repeatedly quoted the most crucial point in the 1872 preface to the Communist Manifesto, it was written after the Commune, where Marx and Engels stated that, quote, the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. And what Bernstein argued is that Marx and Engels were actually there cautioning the working class about being too ambitious about what could be done with the state. In other words, he was claiming that Marx was cautioning the workers against too much zeal in trying to make use of the existing state. He didn't actually mention the conclusion that Marx drew from that sentence, which is that the existing state needed to be smashed, broken up, and replaced with the armed workers organized as a state. And Lenin noted that, quote, a more crude and hideous distortion of Marx's idea cannot be imagined. And yet Kautsky did not denounce Bernstein for this distortion in his criticism. He implied that Marx's statement was not an absolute, and that despite this, Marx was agnostic on what could be done with the existing state. He said, and this is a quote again, he says, we can quite safely leave the solution of the problems of the proletarian dictatorship to the future. And he failed to attack that obvious distortion in Bernstein's work, which would have meant, of course, that he'd have to acknowledge himself Marx's position on the need to smash the state. So Lenin actually noted that what Kautsky was doing was something like this. He said, this is not a polemic against Bernstein, but in essence, a concession to him, a surrender to opportunism. For at present, the opportunists ask nothing better than to quite safely leave to the future all fundamental system questions of the tasks of the proletarian revolution. Now, Kautsky again avoided the issue of the state in some subsequent and quite celebrated works. He wrote a work called The Social Revolution in 1902, when, in the words of Lenin again, he, quote, chose as his special theme the question of the proletarian revolution and the proletarian regime. He gave much that was exceedingly valuable, but he avoided the question of the state. And he wrote, and Lenin noted that, quote, Kautsky treats the matter as follows. The victorious proletariat will carry out the democratic program. And he goes on to formulate its clauses. But he doesn't say a word about the new material provided in 1871 on the subject of the replacement of bourgeois democracy by proletarian democracy. And what Kautsky simply said instead was this. It said, still, it goes without saying that we will not achieve supremacy under the present conditions. Revolution itself presupposes long and deep-going struggles, which in themselves will change our political and social structure. Now, changing the present structure implies evolution, and not the sharp disjuncture signified by the call to smash the existing state and replace it with a proletarian dictatorship. Instead, he wrote that, and this is a quote, he said, the most varied forms of enterprises, bureaucratic, trade unionist, cooperative, private, can exist side by side in socialist society. There are, for example, enterprises which cannot do without a bureaucratic organisation, such as the railways. Here, the democratic organisation may take the following shape. The workers elect delegates who form a sort of parliament, which establishes the working relations and supervises the management of the bureaucratic apparatus. Lenin was sharply critical of that, and he counterposed the following. He said, the workers, after winning political power, will smash the old bureaucratic apparatus, shatter it to its very foundations, and raise it to the ground. They will replace it by a new one, consisting of the very same workers and other employees, against whose transformation into bureaucratism will at once be taken, which was specified in detail by Marx and Engels. 1. Not only election, but also recall at any time. 2. Pay not to exceed that of a workman. 3. Immediate introduction of control by all, so that all can become bureaucrats for a time, and they're bureaucrats in quotes, and therefore nobody will be able to become a bureaucrat, in quotes again, obviously. And Lenin then criticizes Kautsky's last work against the opportunists, which is called The Road to Power, which was written in 1909. And he notes that in this book, the author explicitly points to the aggravation of class antagonisms in general and to imperialism, which plays a particularly important part in this respect. After the revolutionary period of 1789 to 1871 in Western Europe, he says, a similar period began in the East in 1905. A world war is approaching with menacing rapidity. And the proletariat, that is, can no longer talk of premature revolution. We have entered a revolutionary period. The revolutionary era is beginning. That's what Kautsky said in 1909. And yet, again, for all this, Lenin notes this. He says, although Kautsky was so explicitly declared that the era of revolution had already begun, in the pamphlet which he himself was devoted to an analysis of the political revolution, he completely avoided the question of the state. And Lenin noted that this pamphlet of Kautsky's should serve as a measure of comparison of what the German Social Democrats promised to be before the imperialist war and the depth of degradation to which they, including Kautsky himself, sank when the war broke out. These evasions of the question, these omissions and equivocations, inevitably added up to the complete swing over to opportunism, which we'll now have to deal. And in dealing with that, he deals with Kautsky's controversy with a Dutch communist called Anton Pannekoek in the fourth section of this chapter. Now, Pannekoek was one of the so-called left radicals, that trend in the Second International. And he was aligned with Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Radek. And after the war, Pannekoek became one of the ultra-lefts that Lenin, so-called ultra-lefts, well, they were ultra-lefts, that Lenin was compelled to oppose in the early Communist International. And it, you know, if you read the passages that are quoted in this chapter, there are some signs of those flaws, but nevertheless, against Kautsky, he was on the right track. And Pannekoek, in a 1912 article called Mass Action and Revolution, described Kautsky's position as passive radicalism, or as a theory of inactive expectancy. And he said that Kautsky refuses to see the process of revolution. And then he went on to say this. He said, the struggle of the proletariat is not merely a struggle for the bourgeoisie against state power, but a struggle against state power. The content of this revolution is the destruction and dissolution of the instruments of power of the state with the aid of the instruments of power of the proletariat. And then he carries on and he says, the struggle will cease only when, as a result of it, the state organization is completely destroyed. The organization of the majority will then have demonstrated its superiority by destroying the organization of the ruling minority. Now, I mean, that's formulated in a slightly odd way, but if you examine it carefully, it does actually imply that the new state of the proletariat, the workers' state effectively, proves its superiority by, quote, destroying the state organization of the ruling minority, which is actually a revolutionary position. And Kautsky responded to this by saying that, this is what he said. He said, up to now, the antithesis between the Social Democrats and the anarchists has been that the former wish to win the state power, while the latter wish to destroy it. Panikkerk wants to do both. And as Lenin pointed out with this criticism, he says that Kautsky completely abandoned the Marxist position and went over wholly to opposition, to opportunism. And he said his definition of the distinction between the Social Democrats and the anarchists is absolutely wrong. He completely vulgarizes and distorts Marxism. And Lenin points out the complete dishonesty of Kautsky's argument against Panikkerk. When he tried to say that Panikkerk wanted to destroy centralism in the state, whereas Marx had said, in another context, he'd said that resolute centralization of power in the hands of the state authority was essential. But he said that in a different context. And Kautsky lectured Panikkerk that said, no, not one of the present ministries will be removed by our political struggle against the government. I repeat, in order to prevent misunderstanding, we are not discussing here the form the future state will be given by the victorious Social Democrats, but how the present state is changed by our opposition. And Lenin responded to that by saying this. He said, this is an obvious trick. Panikkerk raised the question of revolution. Kautsky substitutes the opposition. The opportunist for the revolutionary point of view. What he says means, at present we are in opposition. What we shall be after we've captured power, that we will see. Revolution has vanished, and that is exactly what the opportunists wanted. The point at issue is neither opposition nor political struggle in general, but revolution. Revolution consists in the proletariat destroying the administrative apparatus and the whole state machine, replacing it by a new one, made up of the armed workers. Kautsky demands a, quote, superstitious reverence for ministries. But why can they not be replaced, say, by committees of specialists working under sovereign, all-powerful Soviets of workers' and soldiers' deputies? And Kautsky's whole horizon in this discussion was within the terrain of the existing state. And Lenin again says this, he says, according to Kautsky, since elected functionaries will remain under socialism, so will officials, so will the bureaucracy. But Marx, referring to the example of the commune, showed that under socialism, functionaries will cease to be bureaucrats, cease to be officials. They'll cease to be so in proportion as, in addition to the principle of election of officials, the principle of recall at any time is also introduced, and so as salaries are reduced to the level of the wages of the average workman, and as parliamentary institutions are replaced by working bodies, executive and legislative, at the same time. Now, we're not going to go into too much fine detail here, but suffice to say that Lenin criticizes Kautsky's reverence for the existing state, its bureaucracies, its ministries, etc., and notes that Kautsky completely avoids the question of revolution and the need to destroy the existing state. And he uses a sort of sophistry to accuse Panikkerk of opposing centralization. But what Panikkerk is actually advocating, albeit using bombastic language that Lenin considers to be counterproductive in explaining the issue, what he's actually advocating is the smashing of the existing state and its replacement by the working class organized as the new state power. And Kautsky makes it very pretty much clear his opposition to this when he argues the following. He says, its object, that is the object of the mass strike, he's talking about mass strikes, cannot be to destroy the state power. Its only object can be to make the government compliant on some specific question, or to replace a government hostile to the proletariat by one willing to meet it halfway. But never, under no circumstances, can it, what he means by it is the proletarian victory over a hostile government, it appears. Now, under no circumstances can it lead to the destruction of the state power. It can lead only to a certain shifting of the balance of forces within the state power. The aim of our political struggle remains, as in the past, the conquest of state power by winning a majority in Parliament and raising Parliament to the ranks of master of the government. So, in a sense, the real content of Kautsky's earlier left centrism in the work called The Social Revolution, and then there's a work called The Road to Power, as we quoted a little bit earlier, is revealed. And Lenin said about this, he said, "This is nothing but the purest and most vulgar opportunism, repudiating revolution in deeds while accepting it in words." Kautsky's thoughts go no further than a government willing to meet the proletariat halfway. And that's a step backwards to Philistinism compared with 1847, when the Communist Manifesto proclaimed its objective of the organisation of the proletariat as the ruling class. And Kautsky will have to achieve his beloved unity with the Scheidemanns, the Plekhanovs, the Van der Velds. Those are the leaders of social democracy who ended up supporting the war, all of them, all of whom agree to fight for a government willing to meet the proletariat halfway. But Lenin says, "We, however, shall break with these traitors to socialism, and we shall fight for the complete destruction of the old state machine in order that the armed proletariat itself may become the government. These are two vastly different things." So what's instructive about all this is that all these issues were fought out before the decisive betrayal of German social democracy, and well, of social democracy generally, in 1914. The signs were actually there, and Rosa Luxemburg, who was active in the German party at that time, picked them up more quickly than Lenin, who was probably, well, he was geographically more distant from Kautsky's real-world activities anyway, you know. So Kautsky's centrism that led him to give a left cover to the social chauvinists and social imperialists during the war, and to oppose the creation of a new Third International to combat and overthrow the Second International before it went wholesale over to imperialism, was actually clearly visible before the war. And that is really what the chapter is about. I mean, I'm going to finish there because I think we've been through the bulk of what's in it. Not in too fine a detail, but that's the broad thrust of it. So I'll leave it there and open it up to discussion, comrades. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. That was a very good talk. Now, comrades, for those who wish to ask a question or to make a contribution, those on camera can just use your physical hand. Those who aren't, please use your virtual hand. And as I say, please keep it to one at a time. So, who wants to go first? Stephanie, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll go first because I'll have to leave in a few minutes. Thank you. That was well done. That was interesting. It's I did my homework, unlike some people here. I think the moral of the story is that what goes around comes around. Aren't we facing the same battles, the same difficulties? Again, we've got the so-called reformists versus people that want to, people that, let's say, socialists socialists / communists, in that, yes, we do agree that this the state is something that needs to be, quite frankly, demolished. It's serving no useful purpose except for the people with money. And so, yes, so there is a need for a revolution, and again, at the same time, unfortunately, we're also living, here maybe I'll start a big debate here, we're also living in a situation where actually I see this in the quote that Max put in, the quote, but it doesn't mean we smash their printing presses. We must use them for our own purposes. So the thing is, right now we are living in a capitalist society. And again, there are often times when we have no choice, especially women, I'll say this especially women, but to have recourse to the law to resolve some very serious issues such as, you know, rape or whatever. And then actually then we've got the situation. My friend Deborah, for instance, is taking your party to court, small claims court in this case. She can't afford anything else. But again, because your party has not reneged on its constitution in some of the actions that it's been up to. So again, and she has been damned for it. Not because she's not because poor old Corbyn, you know, she's against Corbyn on this one, and then again, but at the same time, there's the old adage: oh, socialists don't go to bureaucratic or bourgeois courts, you know. So it's I say the problems are still here. Is a revolution possible at this point? I think it's still worth pursuing, and that's my 10. But 2p.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Anybody else?
Thanks, Stephanie. Do you want to come, Ian? Do you want to come back on some of that?
Well, I'm going to say a couple of words about that. I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to what Debs has done either, but because it's outrageous. I mean, I'm sceptical about how useful it will ever be, because I don't think they will. I don't think she stands much chance of making much progress against these people in court. But, you know, I mean, there are situations where people blatantly violate your rights in politics, and my view of it is that we don't just voluntarily hand over our rights. If we can actually mobilize to defeat them, then that's all to the good. But there's no absolute prohibition about it. I mean, there was a situation in the, what was it, in PCS. I mean, there's about 20 years ago, there was a situation where I think Mark Sawatka got elected as General Secretary of PCS. And the existing bureaucracy blatantly said, you're not really allowed to take office. You're not, you know, he's overwhelmingly elected, and they tried to stop him from being the general secretary. What did he do? He went to court and he won in about 2 seconds flat, because it was so blatantly, outrageously illegal that they had no choice but to say, well, the election was valid, wasn't it? You know. And I think in situations like that, you can't really condemn people for going, for just defending their rights under bourgeois legality. We don't have a strategy of using the courts to change things, though. You know, it's not a strategy for changing politics. But sometimes things are so blatantly outrageous that there's not much you can say about it, really. I think there's been a certain level of... the other thing is that we've had the spectacle of Zionists intervening in politics in the last several years, and so many, you know, the whole Corbyn witch hunt, so many outrageous things were done that I don't think Zionists are part of the workers' movement, and they tend to intervene and try to sort of stop opposition from cohering to their position and their entrenched positions in politics. And I think we you know, we're not. There's no principle against going to court to prevent against Zionists. Was it the situation where Jeremy Corbyn was called a fucking racist anti-Semite by Margaret Hodge, who's one of these friends of Israel? And one of the criticisms I would have of Corbyn is he didn't actually do anything about it. You know, what he could have done is expelled her from the party and sued her for libel. And he probably would have won in both cases. It was just so outrageous and so blatant. But what did he do instead? Nothing. You know, he basically sat there and accepted it. And I'm not a purist on this. I don't have a strategy of using the courts or, legality to change politics, because that's not going to work, because the bourgeoisie will not, they're not our friends. They will not help us in revolutionizing politics or anything like that. But I'm not a purist either, and I think that some situations you get bureaucratic forces that are so outrageously they try to, somebody walked off with two. I'm not going to name that person, but I was in another organization a while ago, and somebody walked off with $2,000 of our money and blatantly justified it politically. I'm not going to go into the details. I mean, what do you do about that if someone steals thousands of pounds from an organization's treasury and blatantly says they're doing it for political reasons? What can you do other than, or the other situation was the SWP, when their general secretary was accused of raping somebody. But they do not have the capacity to even remotely investigate that, and they tried, and they've discredited themselves, as they inevitably would, because they haven't got the means to do it impartially. And the idea that they could be impartial is for the birds, so that's that stuff that we, those are difficult things you have to deal with. But in general, we're opposed to, we are opponents of state power. As I think it was Max who said that something about people being jailed for carrying placards, or people are being arrested for carrying placards in their thousands in this country, we have, there are organizations that are supporting them, but it's an ongoing battle, Anyway, those are some disjointed points about this, really. I think in general the state is not our friend, but that doesn't mean we should just sit back and accept being treated like dirt by people who've, who think they can get away with it, sort of thing. Paul.
Just a small technical point. That Margaret Hogg incident, before I bring Stephanie back in, I don't think Corbyn could have done anything about that particular one by virtue of the fact that Margaret Hogg said it on the floor of the House of Commons. That's a peculiar technicality that gets you away with things like that. But if she said it outside the House of Commons, then he would have had a case. But I believe she said it on the floor of the House of Commons. So that covered her, what do you call it? Stephanie, go
Yeah,
ahead.
you're right.
Yeah, well, she's a cow, to say the least. So, yeah, okay, I'm just going to say, well, again, we've got, look, I always like to bring, when I do history, I always like to bring it into the present, make it present back and forth. And again, the very present, of course, is this fiasco with your party and the CEC. The story in a nutshell for our American friend and others that don't know is quite simply that three representatives on our CEC, Central Executive Commission, I guess it was called, committee, they decided, well, two of them decided to go to this organization that was being built called Socialist Federation. And now, for those who went, though, the two that went, one gave a brief speech, not about your party, but a speech of solidarity. When I heard that, I thought, well, no, that's not really a good idea, because again, it's sort of a, if you read the literature of this group, is that it's very anti your party. It wants to be the alternative to your party, or wants to pick up where your party left off. So anyway, what happened is that these two members, along with a third member, were sent letters a couple of days afterwards, were sent letters by the chair and the secretary of your party, CEC, saying, oh, you cannot attend this upcoming meeting, which was on, of all things, on racism and what we're going to do about it. And again, in this case, we had one black woman, one Muslim woman of Pakistani descent, and another was Jewish. And, you know, to stop them from going to a meeting on racism or anti-racism, yeah, it was bizarre. So it was also bizarre because the third woman hadn't gone to this meeting at all. So she was being accused of something she didn't do. So what happened is people were uproared, and people not just on the group that these three came from, this was what we call the grassroots left. They, along with others in the group, which formed called the Many, which were people that were in power in effect. Few of them, enough of a majority. There was a call by a member of the Many to a call for the a vote of no confidence against the chair. So a meeting was held, and they, you know, there was a vote of no confidence against the chair, against the secretary, and then also, for some reason, they decided to throw in a vote of no confidence to the membership secretary, because membership has been going out of, or the building of branches has been going at a snail's pace. So anyway, the situation, they had that meeting then, but the chair and those refused to accept it. Jeremy Corbyn was pissed off, not at the chair, but at these people who would dare accuse the chair, or, you know, vote against the chair. So there was a meeting on the 20th, and it broke up after a two-hour debate on whether or not the chair should be remaining in the group, because, again, she had been voted out at the previous meeting. And even now, the subsequent meeting, the subsequent correspondence from the chair is, you know, basically saying how she's defeated these people. And the thing is, it's a horrible mess. And it's at an impasse right now. And again, it's really hard to define what is really the problem here. Are these, you know, I don't, you know, knowing, not knowing them well, but knowing them well enough, I don't think the people that voted against the chair were seeking a power grab. I think they just wanted to be a part, you know, be treated as a part of the group and making decisions and debating things, as they had not been ever since the CEC came into effect. So again, it's, how am I saying this? Again, it's, you know, well, what do you do in circumstances such as that? That's a rhetorical, you don't have to explain it, because again, they're going to do something. And so it's more or less, you know, just get out the popcorn and see what happens. But it's still, I think, what has happened in the past comes back into the present, and vice versa. We look at the past from the present. You know, we look to the past to try and answer some questions. And like I said, as I was saying earlier, the what comes around goes around. It's you know, aren't we dealing with the same issues? The language is a bit different, but again, it's still the same problems. So.
Thanks, Stephanie. I was about to say, actually, okay, for people listening in when the recording goes out, they could be forgiven for thinking that we have gone a bit far from the text. On the other hand, the text and what's happening now demonstrate what would happen if we are arguably in a revolutionary situation at some point. So thanks, Stephanie. Ian, do you want to come back on any of that?
Well, I think personally, I think that what's happened politically is that Corbyn's faction, the many, which was obviously there was a competition between two slates in the election of the CEC early in the year. That faction which won the election has now disintegrated. And we don't know what the ultimate impact of that will be on Corbyn. The best possible outcome would be if Corbyn resigned and left. And I think there's a real possibility of that. The only thing is that he has to weigh up. This is discrediting him, and he might decide to cut his losses and go. The way he's keeping control, or the way the clique around him are keeping control of the party, is not no longer through a majority on the CEC, but simply through control of the data and the membership records, because they're the only people who've got their hands on it. The CEC does not have access to it even. That's how bureaucratic it is. Now, what we can do about that, I'm not really sure, but... it may be that we might end up having an organisation with only limited access to data, and that they might even maliciously delete it or something stupid like that. I wouldn't say that's beyond the realms of possibility, but we would have, if they split away, if they are forced to concede something, we might get our hands on the data eventually. But what we'd also get is the political authority of having won the factional battle. So I think it's worth sticking it out, and not just walking away until it's completely clear that everything's lost. Because I don't think everything's lost at all. The fact that Corbyn's faction has split is really quite something, and it was set up in order to frustrate everybody, and it was done in a manipulative and undemocratic way, and I think that's alienated some of the people he got involved. And I've noticed on social media as well, there are people who were hardline Corbynites a few weeks ago and now very, very angry about what Corbyn has done. And Hannah Hawkins is probably the most notorious example, because she was rabid against dual membership, against anybody who was a dissident, and that was only a couple of months ago. Now she's one of the dissidents. And I just think, well, these people have had a light bulb go off in their head, and the pressure they were put under to do things that really are not good, and they damage their own reputation by doing it, has caused this faction to disintegrate. But I don't think Corbyn is a hardened gangster, like a Jerry Healey type figure either. I think he's quite soft, and I think under enough pressure he might walk away. And he's already half walked away, because what he's done recently is he changed his description. For months and months and months he described himself in Parliament as an independent, and then when Andy Burnham became leader of the Labour Party and made it clear that he would not get back in, he put his designation as being a Your Party MP. But he was interviewed on Newsnight the other day, and he said he was an independent again. He wanted to continue being an independent. So he'd obviously forgotten that he'd changed his designation. I mean, the only actual Your Party MP who's been systematic about it is Zara. And it does show the difference, you know. And of course, Zara is still there. I understand she's got personal reasons and I won't go into those, why she's not as active as she was for the moment. But But she's still very much there, and I think there's still the possibility of a splintering away of Corbyn, of what's left of his faction, and then we could actually get something done. So I'm not walking away yet. That's my view of it, anyway.
I'm sorry, I have to go. A pleasure.
Okay.
Okay, take care.
Take care. See you soon.
Take care, Stephanie. I was gonna say that there could be a possibility that somebody, I guess one question will be, is if there's a data breach of some sort that might come up, and that might cause them problems in the future. I'm not sure, but I think the whole question of what's going on at the moment now, the one thing that sticks in my head is that they've clearly got money from our membership, and the question becomes, what are they doing with it? And I'm afraid I'm kind of thinking about whether I could stay in, because I'd rather resent my even though it may be small, my membership money being used as a potential slush fund for people in and around Corbyn. And I do get the feeling that it is a bit like that. That's my take on the current situation with your party, anyway. If I may, can I bring it back to, is there anything Conroy wished to say in regard to the text that we're actually supposed to be studying?
Well, I'd like to say something.
Go on, Max.
When I read it, I wrote in a lot of stuff in the chat about my feeling about it. It's like, oh, why are they talking about this? Like, and I have to put myself in Lenin's position 100 years ago. Oh, okay. It's like, oh, so it's assumed. A lot of things are assumed, like when that I have questions about, or I get stuck. Like I've been typing in the chat, like what is he talking about the state? What is he talking about smash the machinery? And okay, like it's theoretical. What are you really going to do? Are you going to smash the factory to the ground and build the machine, or are you going to use the machine and appropriate it? What are you talking about? So I said, okay. I guess they're talking about administratively and so on, and that sort of answered itself. But it's still not that clear to me concretely why these guys were talking about these things so intensely at that time. And also, like, it reminds me of the discussion when they're talking about the withering away of the state. Well, were they talking about some ideal utopian version of the revolution? It's not going to happen that way. I understand it's a question of principle, and I understand when I read it, like, oh, this must have been important back then because, and it's still important now, but something about it feels a little dry and kind of like, I wonder sort of top down, but I might be wrong. I mean, I understand Kautsky played a counter-revolutionary role between 1905 and 1917, but still, when I read this stuff, sometimes it feels so dry and they just assume that you know about every, Proudhon. I mean, how much of this is relevant today? And if so, how is it relevant? Like, what are we really talking about? And like I typed in, when you get to stuff like the in military industrial complex, it did exist back then, but it exists even more today. So even if we have a revolution in part of a country, like in the United States or Brazil or some big country, it's not going to be the whole country all at once, as the I mean, we don't have the organization, first of all. We need organizations. My thing as a Deleuzeist and a Trotskyist is we have to not just focus on, if any criticism I have of us Trotskyists is that we can't just focus, or not really this group, but my experience over years with other Trotskyists, this group is actually probably on the same page as I am. What is this, this focus on, we have, because of the, you know, the Trotsky idea that, you know, the fundamental problem is the leader, you know, this fourth international, like with the party, this focus on party. Okay, fine. But I don't think we're going to have a revolution.
Matt,
we're not going to have a revolution. Let me give me 30 seconds. My point is we have to also combination the idea of a party with the organizations like Soviets and socialist industrial unions and any other kind of mass organization, but not partisan ones, more like trade unionists or something else, is my point. The workers have to be organized.
Can I come back on that? Because I think it's very important. The reason we're discussing state and revolution is because we joined in what is a sort of a semi-parliamentary party project, but not entirely. It wasn't clear that people wanted a parliamentary party purely, right? Which is the party that was founded by Zara Sultana she roped in Jeremy Corbyn, and she probably shouldn't have done that really, but attempted to anyway, but he's been very destructive and his followers have been quite destructive. Almost exactly a year ago, we got involved in this, right? Because it was actually announced over a year ago, and something like, you know, once it got itself up and running, 800,000 people in Britain expressed an interest in joining it, which is a lot of people, you know, so that's why we got involved in it. And it's turned out to be a factional nightmare, but that's what you'd expect to some extent, you know. But the point is that this stuff is written about a similar situation in some ways. The question of what your attitude is towards parliamentary politics, what your attitude is towards workers' representation or representations of leaders of a political party that ostensibly is for the working class. And what we want for them is what we want, the same ethos as the ethos of the Paris Commune and of the things that Lenin was advocating in this pamphlet, The State and Revolution, which is simply this. We do not want We do not want privileged parliamentary representatives who are divorced from the working class in terms of their lifestyle and their standard of living. And we want people who are paid basically the same amount of money as everybody else who works for a living and is accountable for what they do to those people, the working class supporters of the party. And that is, you know, that if you consciously do away with that, you're on the road to creating something that could become a revolutionary party, because you don't have the basis for a Labour bureaucracy. You don't have the basis for a parliamentary bureaucracy or something that's corrupted by parliamentarism. And I thought it, you know, I think it's very important, and we're not the only people that have used this particular text to make these points. I think the Bolshevik tendency have been doing something similar, but we haven't really been able to coordinate with them because they've got a slightly different attitude to your party, and they've really walked away from it now. Prematurely, in my view. The idea is we want that this is part of the antidote to parliamentary opportunism. And we're advocating this within a proto-parliamentary party, or something that could be a proto-parliamentary party. And I think that's an important thing that we're trying to do. And that's the rationale for it. In other words, it's not a sterile thing. It's something that's used. We're trying to use to intervene. I think Stephanie we haven't had a great success because we've been witch hunted in this organisation by sort of factional opponents on the far left who are pro-Zionist or soft on Zionism. You know, we've had that problem. We're also fighting to defeat those people. So it's a twin track struggle, but this is what we wanted to do all along, is to actually, you know, sort of interact with members, ordinary sort of highly political people like Stephanie, for instance, who's an activist in your party in Southeast London. And we've had other comrades here as well. Some of them, there's a couple of others who promised that they would try and come, but they weren't able to get here, because of other things. But that's what we're trying to do anyway. It's small beginnings in a way, but this project is not, in my opinion, your party is not dead yet. It's in danger of asphyxiation, but it's not dead yet. And who knows? The Corbyn's faction has disintegrated. It could be, it could be the beginning of a new start for it, for all we know. You know, it's not outside the realms of possibility, but it's a dicey situation. But we need to intervene in this layer of people. Yeah, but irrespective of your party, there is a felt need for such a party, irrespective of the specifics. And people want to create one, even if your party doesn't, if it goes down the plug hole, there'll be an attempt to create something else, you know. And you know, we are actually we want to be part of that, so we can win people and we can win influence in it, and we can actually build something substantial. Well, that's our aspiration, you know. That's all I can say.
Thanks, Ian. There are some comrades who haven't yet spoken. Ah, Diana, you want to say something? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the UK state is crying out to be smashed, but it looks unbreakable to me. And not only that, because we've got that dreadful monarchy thing, and then our government's been effectively taken over by Israel, and we've been a vassal state of the US at least since the end of World War II, maybe before that. I don't know how you smash all, how you get rid of those bums. But there's an example of revolutionary state that did manage to smash the state. That is the Cuban Revolution. So it'd be worth knowing more about that and how they did it. It's something I should have thought more about and didn't and haven't. Because they all obviously managed to get rid of was it the Batista family, and stop Cuba being used as a brothel for the US rich. They've paid a heavy price for it, but they've survived, and they're still more or less surviving. So maybe looking at their example is worth doing. But I just don't know how you get rid of the British monarchy and Israel, the stranglehold of Israel and the US.
Thanks, Dan. Ian, do you want to come back on that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, how do you smash the state? I mean, yes, we have a monarchy. We have Zionists in positions of power, but you have to realise that in Tsarist Russia, when this was written, you had an absolute monarchy and the Okhrana, the terrorist secret police, and all the terrible attributes of Tsarism. You know, I think that we try to mobilise the masses, don't we? We try to find roads to mobilizing the masses. And when 800,000 class conscious people declare they want to be part of a new working class party, which is how it was posed about a year, almost exactly a year ago, slightly less than a year ago, actually. But the first idea of it, yeah, it was about a year ago. This was posed. I think the actual sign-up happened in August. But nevertheless, you know, when people declare en masse that they want a new working class party, that's a step towards mobilising the masses to do something, but to get involved in it and participate in it. And that, it's not us that's going to smash the state or bring down the monarchy or drive out the Zionists or whatever. It's the masses, you know. And that's what we're trying to, that's what we tried to do. That's what we're trying to do with intervening in the party, in the Corbyn Sultana party, which may become hopefully will become a Sultana led party or something along those lines. It would be much better if it was, if Corbyn buggered off, you know, but who knows, you know, Zara. But you know, is Corbyn a so Max asks, is Corbyn a socialist or not? And the answer is, he's a left-wing social democrat who's been forced into the situation with a neoliberal right-wing Zionist-dominated party to be an oppositionist. But he's capitulated. Zara Sultana is a more left-wing social democrat, probably in her origin, but she wants to go. Some of the things she says makes it, you know, looks like she wants to go further than that, and she wants a party of class war. That's exactly what the things that she said in one of her, in some of her speeches before the shit really hit the fan factionally. But, you know, she's denounced Corbyn for, well, not denounced it, but criticised Corbyn quite strongly for capitulating to Zionism when he was a Labour leader. You know, things like that are politically important and, you know, they point in the right direction. So we have a positive attitude to it. It doesn't mean we're not uncritical of her. She's not a revolutionary socialist. Probably quite a long way from that, but moving somewhat in the right direction. And if people can mobilize a chunk of the vast of the masses to go in something that's going in the right direction, we want to be part of it, at least, you know, to try and push it further in the right direction. And if we come up against resistance, we will, you know, we do, you know. But, you know, we are, yeah, we're doing our best anyway. We're a very small group. That's all I can say. Yeah.
Are there any other contributions? We've still got a couple of comrades who haven't yet spoken. So, I would encourage you to say something if there's anything you wish to say.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Really, just to say, is insurgency through education the way to go and the only way to go, therefore, as opposed to armed insurgency? I mean, I've no problem with the idea of armed insurgency, but is it realistic in this day and age? And is education, although vital, is it enough on its own? What do you think?
Well, I think you could have armed insurgency, you know, but you need to have much more people involved to even have that. You know, I mean, the in Russia, there was no absolute counterposition. You had the Soviets of workers and soldiers deputies, and the soldiers had guns, and they had Red Guards and armed workers militias and things like this were formed out of them, you know. But we don't have such people at the moment. We're a long way from that in Britain. If, you know, but it could change, you know. But I think that the sort of thing that was promised by your party, but by the 800,000 signing up for it, you know, it could lead anywhere, couldn't it? You know, if it had been allowed to, you know. But it's proved to be more popular.
Who started it? Where did it come from? That's what I want to know.
It came when Labour MPs were basically driven out of the party for opposing austerity and, you know, attacks on the working class.
So if Corbyn people were you said Labour?
Matt,
people were
Labour Party.
Matt, please don't shout across. You should indicate when you would speak.
Yeah. But yeah, it was the Labour Party. It's the Labour Party, you know, that we had. It's explained in the late 2000s. We had the first leader of the Labour Party elected in 2015, who was not a neoliberal, right? Who was a actual social democrat, who actually wanted to, you know, that old style social democratic reforms as opposed to privatisation and all that shit, which has been going on since the days of Thatcher. And the Labour Party leadership has gone along with it. And then Corbyn was elected under a wave of working class resistance, and he was elected overwhelmingly by the Labour Party's base. And it was a working class political rebellion. And then there was the nobbling of him, the destruction of his leadership, partly by Zionists, partly by the traditional right wing, but, you know, it was bad. And, you know, that itself was a huge attack on the working class in this country. You had a thing called Labour Together formed, which was a party within a party, a right wing party within a party, that was funded by Zionist money, and which, you know, carried out a massive smear campaign and eventually caused Corbyn to lose a general election and then forced him out, you know. And then there's been a witch hunt against Corbyn's former followers for their sometime, you know. Corbyn is not that good. Well, he is and he isn't. He's done some honourable things, but he's also done some very stupid and capitulatory things. And there was a huge witch hunt. He was eventually chucked out of the Labour Party. He was deprived of the Labour whip, which meant he was kicked out of the parliamentary faction. He was forced, he wasn't allowed to stand as a candidate, and so he eventually had to stand as an independent to stay in Parliament, and he did that, which of course got him expelled from the Labour Party. My point is that he should have actually left the Labour Party much earlier. Now, what Zara Sultana did is she was a much younger MP. Corbyn is in his mid-70s or something like this. But Zara Sultana is only 30 years old or 33 years old or something like that, you know. And so she came along, very left-wing, new Muslim woman MP, and she walked out of the Labour Party almost exactly a year ago. And she said, I'm going to try and create a new political party, and I'm going to do it with Jeremy Corbyn, hopefully, or something like that. And she approached him, and he's not been very good, put it that way. He's been a disloyal partner, you know. Political partner, you know, and it's turned into a factional war between people who defend her and people who defend him. And that what happened is the Corbyn faction won a majority, but now it's disintegrated. So that's the interesting situation we're in, you know. So that's I hope that explains what we're talking about.
If there's nothing to say with regard to the text, then I think we'd better make this point from Matt. Probably the last question, I think, or conclusion. And then wind it up, maybe. Is that a
game? Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, well, I could switch the recording off anyway, if that's what people like.
Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, the reason I ask these questions is I'm trying to wrap my mind around some of these things, like who is Corbyn, because take a guy like, I'm trying to make parallels from my experience in the United States. I don't really understand how the UK system is. You have different terminology, different things. It's like, okay, this sounds like this. And sometimes I get it wrong because I don't understand how your system works. That's what I'm saying. On principle, we're on the same page. That being said, I keep asking about Corbyn because I've gotten different information. I'm not sure, like, can I compare him to Bernie Sanders? Can I compare him to Zora Mandani? Because, you know, these things are full of surprises. If you'd asked me 2 months ago, you heard me, I'm slamming the DSA, criticizing the DSA because I had some real concrete bad experiences with these fucking people. And then now I'm finding the only group I can talk to in the world is the smoker. Is these very, you know, the reason I'm trying to say is, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of times you're not hearing what I'm saying. I'm asking questions because I really don't understand. Okay, that being said, that's why I said, where is it? Where is it coming from? So for me, I met Pete Gregson a while back. He came to New York and I met him. And at the time, I was a little wary of everything because I was going through, I was meeting a lot of socialists who were just terrible everywhere I went. So I meet this guy. And now I'm looking back. I had to apologize to the guy because I was like, no, you're, he was a Corbynite, but he sounded like a socialist. I walked down the street with him for an afternoon, like 2 or 3 hours, and I met the guy. And then in retrospect, I see he's doing a lot of good things, and he's a Corbynite. He's not a real socialist. But sometimes the people that are doing what the working class needs to do aren't like us. They're not like in their head socialists, but they're actually out there. You know, they're activists or whatever the term is. I don't know why I'm even bringing that up. That's not what I meant to say. But this is the kind of thing. It's because I don't understand how British politics works, how your terminology. It's almost, it's the same language, but it's not the same language. Anyway, I'm kind of curious about Corbyn and Zoltana, because you see them making speeches. But, you know, I saw 10 years ago, I saw Sanders making speeches and thought, well, maybe this guy's going to save us. Some one little part of me thought, maybe this guy's going to save us. But deep in my heart, I knew he was going to betray us. And I wanted him to win. This is how I think. I want him to win so I can say, see, look, he betrayed you. But instead, we got Trump and we got full fascism now. So it doesn't matter. But, you know, it's very frustrating today. It's like everything just keeps getting worse. The fascists keep winning. Where's the, you know, who knows where the, I feel like I'm not involved enough, but in my life I've seen, like, I don't know if anybody here remembers when the Zapatistas fell out of the trees in Chiapas in 1994, January 1st. This is the kind of thing that I'm thinking, well, that took me completely by surprise, but those guys actually did something. They weren't the perfect Trotskyist, Leninist, but this is what I'm interested in. This is why I keep talking about the Leon, these ideas of not just the party, not just the leadership, which of course is important. We need to form organizations. What's happened in the United States in my lifetime is that the trade union is no longer valid as a vehicle because it's so small. It went from 30% to 40% down to like 10% of the working class is in unions. It's very bad. So we have to form something else. Something like a union. That's why I'm encouraging any kind of working class. This is why I'm thinking, like somebody mentioned before, when are we going to have an armed insurrection? We have to think that way. This is war. We have to think. It doesn't have to, you know, we have to organize the work. The people have to be organized one way or the other, whether we do it for them or they do it themselves or both. What we need is power because we're up against people that want to destroy us. You see, it's happening. Fascism is bad. So this is why I focus on, I bring up all this stuff about, let's think in terms of organizing the Red Army. I don't know how these guys did it 100 years ago. Sometimes I think I need to learn more about it. But anyway, I don't want to crank too much. But maybe we should have a reading group on De Leon sometime, because those ideas really appeal to me in their base. Because it's like the Labour Party in Britain. We don't have a Labour Party in the United States. Maybe they have one here in Brazil. Brazil's a good example of a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, too. You have an MST. You have a potentially good, massive organizations. Not only can this bring us revolution, this thing can also stop the harm that fascism has. In fact, Lula's organization actually overthrew fascism in Brazil, despite it not being socialist. So, you know, that's why I'm very interested in people like Corbyn. Like, well, there are these, that whole gray area of social democracy. These people could be our friends or our enemies, these middle, you know, these DSA types. Okay, that's why I talk about it, because I'm trying to figure it out.
Ian, yeah. Do you want to come back on that? And then
just briefly, I mean, I would say that there is a working class party in Brazil. It's led by Lula, and it's the Party de Trabajadores, the Workers' Party. And it's the party that's the biggest party that's in of the government that's in power. I think it's a coalition of some sort. But yeah, I mean, that is a working class. That's a social democratic party, sort of, in a semi-colonial country. You know, it's different. Britain is an imperialist country, so it does, such as the United States, so it's different. But obviously, there's a lot of differences, which are quite profound, actually. You know, I'm sure it's corrupt. So is Britain, but I don't know. I mean, what was it you wanted to have a discussion on? Dilianism. I don't know much about Dilianism, I must admit. You know, I only know a little bit about it.
Well, that's it. Everybody is like that. Almost everybody on the left is like, I just came from that. That's why I know about it.
Right.
But the basic thing for me, De Leon was the American Lenin, but they never made a revolution. But who never made a revolution? And if they had, it would have been a great thing, because the United States even back then was advanced industrial, you know, more than Russia. But, you know, things go the way they go. You can't complain about that. But I think there's a parallel there. And also, you hear a lot of crap from people, especially young socialists today, like, oh, the social, I can't. It's like, there's so much ignorance. They're full of great energy, but they don't know. There's this lie that I heard this in DSA and all of this young, and not just in the United States, the idea of Chris, this idea that, oh, there never was a revolutionary working class in the United States. That's what I hear. It's like, well, you got to go back a little farther before World War, you know? Yes, there was, is what I'm saying. Yes, there was, and there can
that
be. And it's not, you know, this idea that we're all cowboys and rugged individuals, that's bullshit. That's not actually a fascist icon like the Nordic shit from the Nazis. For me, there are cowboys, but most people aren't cowboys in the United States. Most people are workers. So and there was a long history, you know, and it got crushed. And that's the lesson. You know, that's the lesson. It gets crushed, because if you don't make the revolution, your organization eventually gets crushed. That's, you know, the only thing I've learned, really. But what bugs me is when I see people that can't even go, they can talk about the Russian Revolution, but they don't even know. I'm talking about American young socialists but they don't even know about De Leon. They don't know about the struggles that gave them their 40-hour week. And they sort of know about the 30s, but they're all, even in the DSA, a lot of these groups, all they know about is what the Communist Party did, like, you know, the Stalinists. So we got to fight, not just, you know, all due credit. It's good to fight for Trotskyism. Our principles are important, you know. So it's like three things we're fighting, you know. Anyway.
Ian, do you want to come back on that before I make the final summing up remarks?
I think we can wind up now. I mean, I think we can resume this discussion another time, you know.
My problem is I can't contain myself. I can't be contained. That's my problem.
Anyway,
Kamali, that was a very good discussion. We'll hopefully have another meeting on a different subject in about 2 weeks' time. And now we can turn off the recording. Thank you, comrade.
Yeah, I will do that.